The doors got blown out in the 1980s of the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration was openly embracing monopoly, whereas all the previous administrations had considered it an evil, sometimes a necessary evil, but an evil. And Reagan's greed is good philosophy was right there where the big monopolistic corporations needed it.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. In this episode, I interview Tom Hartman, his second time on my show. Tom is a progressive political talk show host, an entrepreneur and author who has a multi-million person weekly audience. He's writing a series of small hidden history books on topics relevant to progressives. We discussed his new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Betrayed the American Dream. So after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Tom Hartman of the Hidden History series and the Tom Hartman Show.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for taking the time. I last spoke with you in the beginning of March. We talked about your Hidden History series, and you're already out with another book. What's it called?
It's The Hidden History of Monopolies and How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. Didn't they get you a copy of the book?
I've read the book. I just thought I would have you say the title rather than me.
Oh.
In fact, it did exactly what you suggested made sense about the length, which was I was able to get it from the post office this morning and read it entirely by this afternoon.
Oh, cool.
So would you mind introducing yourself, giving me a quick biography just for those people who don't know you?
My name is Tom Hartman, and my most recent book is The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream.
And you are a progressive radio talk show host.
I am.
And one of the big ones, really, or if not the biggest.
I guess.
I learned a couple things in this book that I wanted to ask you about and get you to highlight. The first one that really struck me was this notion that Jefferson wanted to put into the Constitution, into the Bill of Rights, something to protect against monopoly. Can you describe how you came across that information and why it didn't get in there and why it would be meaningful?
Well, I came across the information back in 1990, whatever the year was, six or seven. Louise and I moved to Vermont and we bought a house in Montpelier. It was an old fixer-upper. And I found in the attic over the garage an old box of books from the 1920s. There were magazines in there from the 1920s that were all badly water damaged. Among them was a complete collection of the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, which had only been published once in U.S. history, and that was in 1909 by the Thomas Jefferson Association on the 100th anniversary of his departure from the White House, or the end of his presidency. I read it. We just sold a business. I was thinking about being retired. I spent literally the next year reading this collection of books and just, you know, living inside his head for a while. And over and over, and probably the most fascinating part of his life was in particular when he was in France and Madison was back in the United States working on the Constitution, 1787. Madison was in Philadelphia. And Jefferson didn't just write to Madison. He sent numerous letters about this. But the first one that I saw was when Madison sent him the Constitution that they had hammered out You know, they got together from, as I recall, it was like May until September or something like that. It was basically the summer and early fall of 1787. And they wrote the Constitution. And Madison sent a copy to Jefferson in Paris and said, "What do you think, boss?" Jefferson was Madison's mentor. Jefferson was a little bit older than, actually, I think about 20 years older than Madison. And they had this, you know, very, very strong relationship. Each was the closest friend to the other. And Jefferson sends him back this long letter saying, you know, "I love the fact that you've organized the government into three branches of government and that you've, you know, separated powers and there's checks and balances and all this kind of stuff." He said, so he praises Madison for a couple of paragraphs. And then he says, "And now I will tell you what I do not like." And I'm doing this from memory. I think the actual quotes are in the book. He said, "You know, what I do not like, what I believe we must have is an absolute Bill of Rights, which stipulates that the press shall be free, that speech shall be free, that there will be no standing armies during times of peace, and that there will be no monopolies in commerce." And there were a few other things there, you know, due process. And as I recall, there were five or six things on his list. I was like, whoa, no monopolies in commerce? You know, the standing army part of it is also a whole nother fascinating discussion. That's what led us to the Second Amendment. But that's a separate conversation. That's my first book in the series, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. You know, his monopolies in commerce, he was actually opposed to two different things. He had actually been a patent clerk when he was a young man. After he became a lawyer, it was a job that Jefferson had for a little less than a year in Virginia, where he was reviewing patent applications. So he was very familiar with this field. He felt that if we're going to have copyrights, trademarks, and patents, or at least copyrights and patents, I'm not sure trademarks even existed back then. But if we're going to have copyrights and patents, they shouldn't last very long, because the whole point of copywriting or patenting things is to allow people to make some money off their invention, but to incentivize those people to get it into the mainstream of commerce, because every invention stands on the shoulders of what preceded it. Jefferson invented several hundred major inventions, but he never patented any of them. Neither did Ben Franklin, his buddy, you know, who invented bifocal lenses and the Franklin stove and all kinds of amazing, arguably electricity. And so there was that. But then also he was very concerned about accumulated or aggregated wealth, the political power that came with that, both on the individual level. He wrote so many letters about, you know, "I do not trust the rich for our future prosperity, and I do not trust the rich for our political safety," et cetera, et cetera. But also at the corporate level, you know, most of the war that they fought in the American Revolution, well, through that era, right up until 1787, or 1783, I guess it was, whatever the year was. Most of the war that they fought was not just against the British, it was against the British East India Company, which was the world's largest monopolistic corporation at that time. That's what kicked off the Boston Tea Party. So that was his take on all that.
But why didn't it get into the Bill of Rights?
I don't know. The process was not laid out. That would be a question to ask James Madison. Yeah. You know,
well, I don't know if I can get him, except maybe in a musical.
Well, the Bill of, you know, the Bill of Rights was largely hammered out before the Constitution was presented for ratification in 1789. And a lot of that process came out of the individual states ratifying conventions. Probably the Virginia ratifying convention was the most consequential. That was in the fall of 1788, as I recall. The Constitution was written in 1787, and it was ratified, and we became a republic in 1789. The Virginia ratifying convention, I have done a deep dive into, because that's the one that the Second Amendment came out of. That was my first book. And Patrick Henry, of course, was very, very involved in that, because he wanted to protect the slave patrols. That's why the Second Amendment was written in large part. Because Jefferson wrote all these letters to various people who were involved in these things, where the idea that there should not be monopolies in commerce, I'm not sure where that got dropped, frankly.
Yeah, I might have to look into that. I'm curious, after reading the complete works of Jefferson, how do you feel he held up as a complicated man with obviously some, you know, we know now, moral failings, and also a genius who helped set us on the course to being an important democracy?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he was a slaveholder, and there's just no denying that that was as immoral as it gets and as wrong as it gets. He also, in ways that caused him some considerable political pain, fought against slavery, which is kind of a bizarre non sequitur throughout his career, and spoke out loudly about it at the end. He tried to include a paragraph condemning slavery in the Declaration of Independence in 1776. His colleagues said, you can't do that. But to the extent that one can set slavery aside in the context of Jefferson, in the other dimensions of his life, he was a singularly extraordinary person. There's actually a new history of him that just came out in the last year or so. I'm looking around my office here to see if I have it, because I don't remember the author or the title, but I listened to an hour-long interview with her just a few months ago. It was pretty extraordinary. She's an African-American woman who
co-authored. Oh, yeah, I heard reference to that.
Yeah, who co-authored this biography of Jefferson.
Getting great reviews.
I am looking forward to reading. I'm in the middle of writing another one of these hidden history books, and so I haven't had time to do the reading.
What's your next book, Tom?
Well, The Hidden History of Monopolies is hitting the bookstores soon. The Hidden History of Oligarchy and the Rise of Tyranny in America is going to be the one that follows that, and that'll be out next spring. And then next fall will be The Hidden History of Healthcare in the United States.
The next thing that struck me, or another thing that struck me early in the book, was, and you referenced it a little bit, was this idea of the dumping of the tea in the harbor, the Boston Tea Party, being not an anti-tax event, but an anti-monopoly, anti-East India Company event. Can you explain that?
The way that the Boston Tea Party has been sold to us in American history for quite some time, it was based on a truth, but was a lie. The truth was, in 1773, the entire developed world, you know, the Europe and the colonies, basically, at the time, experienced a pretty bad economic crash in the late 1760s and around 1770. And by 1773, the East India Company, the British East India Company, the largest corporation in the world and the largest monopoly, was suffering badly as a result of this worldwide recession. Just to back up a little bit, the East India Company was started in 1601, December 1st, 1601, and signed into creation by Queen Elizabeth I. And she was one of the major stockholders, and they also gave stock to every single member of the House of Lords. And many of the other members of Parliament in the British government owned stock in the British East India Company, in addition to a lot of very, very wealthy people in the United Kingdom. So here's this corporation that has grown from 1600 roughly up until, you know, now we're in 1770. It's been in business 170 years and it's become the richest corporation in the world, but it's like out of cash. They were on the verge of not continuing operations in parts of their operations, which were critical to the British Empire. You know, they ran all the operations in India, for example, which is where the British Empire was manufacturing clothing, and they were importing tea and things like that. So the East India Company went to their stockholders, which were the members of Parliament, the British members of Parliament, and said, we need some cash. And so what Parliament did is, this is called the Tea Act of 1773. You can look it up. I don't know, you know, what you studied in elementary or high school, Nathaniel, but the story that I got growing up was that the British government raised taxes on tea, and the American colonists got pissed off and
that's what I heard. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, what happened with the Tea Act, what it actually was a multi, in today's dollars, a multi-million dollar tax break. And what the British government said to the East India Company was, not only do you not have to pay taxes on any tea that you have in current inventory or any tea that you sell for the next year, but we are giving you a tax refund on the tea that you have in inventory that you have already paid taxes on. Because the way it worked is, when the East India Company brought tea into its warehouses from India or from wherever they got it, that was when it was taxed, as soon as it came into inventory. So they had already paid tax on this tea. And so the British government gave them back the tax money, which was millions and millions of dollars. And it put them back into business. And so then the East India Company, with this massive tax cut, because the tax on tea was a major funder for the British Empire. The main way that the smugglers in North America who were smuggling tea into the colonies, and one of the centers for this was Sam Adams Bar. One of the main ways that they were able to stay in business, because there were tea shops all over the place. They were like Starbucks. There were bars and there were tea shops. And the tea shops were centers of community. There was one in every block in Boston at the time. And all up and down the East Coast. And they were buying this cheaper tea from the pirates, you know, from smuggled tea, because it was cheaper because there was no tax on it. Well, when the East India Company no longer had to pay taxes on their tea, they were able to sell their tea at a price at or below that of the smugglers. They actually, because they had, you know, economies of scale and efficiencies of monopoly, they were actually able to, their tea cost less than the smuggled tea. That was what the colonists were objecting to, was that their tea operations were being put out of business, and the tea shops that were owned by the East India Company were going to be the only ones that survived, and the tea from the East India, et cetera. This was an open revolt against monopoly. It was the equivalent of a whole bunch of small companies in a town going out and burning down the local Walmart the day after it opens. And it was, you know, like I said, it was successful. It kicked off the American Revolution.
Well, I get the sense from reading your book that you're no fan of monopoly.
No.
And the way you tell 20th century history, the heroes are the trust-busting presidents at the beginning and FDR, and the villains are Reagan and Bork. Can you just take us quickly through that history?
Yeah, we've had this bizarre relationship with monopoly throughout the history of the country. There were basically no monopolies in early America because we expelled the East India Company, although we continued to do some business with them after the revolution. But basically, they were, you know, they no longer had any control in the American colonies. And, you know, you had this proliferation of small, locally owned independent businesses all over the country. In the South, the cotton trade caused that to change as a result of the invention of the cotton gin in 1820. And I don't so much drill into that in this book on monopolies. That's in the next book, the book on tyranny and oligarchy. What happened was banking monopolies were emerging in New York, and cotton growing monopolies emerged in the South, because the cotton gin allowed a cotton plantation that had one of these machines to process 50 times more cotton than one that didn't have one of the machines. It would have taken 50 individuals to gin or clean, take the seeds out of the same amount of cotton as this one machine could do hour by hour. And so the larger plantations that could afford to buy the machines, the cotton gins, put all the smaller plantations out of business. And by the 1830s, 1840s, you had basically monopoly power totally concentrated in the South, banking monopoly power totally concentrated in the Northeast. And all of that in many ways brought us to the Civil War. Then after the Civil War, after the failure of Reconstruction in the election of 1876, we then went into this period of rapid industrialization. The railroads had emerged. The railroads were starting to become major players in 1886. I wrote a whole book about a Supreme Court case. It's called Unequal Protection, about a Supreme Court case that had to do with whether corporations are persons. The book is called Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became Persons. You had the railroads. They were bribing members of the Supreme Court. You had the steel giants. You had, you know, by the 1890s, John Rockefeller owned some massive percentage of the oil business. The steel business had been concentrated by Carnegie. The chemical and explosives business was Dow and DuPont. It just went on and on. There was about a dozen of these major oligarchs, and maybe two dozen major oligarchs and oligarchic or monopolistic corporations. And it started to come to a head in the late 1880s, early 1890s, with labor strikes and states trying to push back on this. We got the Sherman Antitrust Act. I think that was 1881. I'd have to go back and look. Where Senator Sherman from Ohio, you know, said, this is it. You can't do this anymore. Ohio did it first. In fact, they kicked John Rockefeller out of the state, or they threatened to put him in jail if he continued to do what he was doing. And he said to basically all the other states, okay, you know, Ohio's making what I'm doing illegal. Who's going to legalize it? I will move my multimillion-dollar business there. And that led to, in a time in the late 1890s, called the chartermongering era, that ran basically from, as I recall, around 1893 to around 1900 or 1901. And during that period of time, the states, particularly in the Northeast, started competing with each other to see who could reduce their regulation of corporate behavior the most. At that time, a corporation in most states couldn't exist for more than 40 years. In many states, it was as few as 20 years. Every year, the Secretary of State had to determine whether the corporation was operating in the public interest. The corporation's first statement of purpose in their articles of incorporation had to be that they were operating to serve the public interest. If the corporation was not doing that, they got the corporate death penalty, they got dissolved, and their assets were sold. I mean, this was fairly common. Thousands of companies got the corporate death penalty for this. And so what happened was, you know, first New Jersey said, "Oh, we'll let you in here, Mr. Rockefeller," and then Delaware said, "Oh, we'll lower the standards even more," and then New York said, "Well, we'll lower them beyond that," and then Connecticut got into the act. Delaware won the race. More than half of the companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange right now are Delaware corporations, even though only a few of them have major headquarters in Delaware. And the reason why is because Delaware has the least restrictive laws. But that was kind of a triumph of monopoly. And so when Teddy Roosevelt became president in 1901, after McKinley was assassinated, he took aim at these corporate monopolies. His aim at them really became ferocious in 1905, because in the election of 1904, one of the hits on him, he had taken some money, or his political party had taken, the Republican Party had taken some money from some of the big monopolists. And so in the election of 1904, I forget who he ran against, but whoever it was just beating him up badly about this. And so in 1905, Teddy Roosevelt comes back just guns blazing. He's going after the monopolies. And he pounded on that for 4 years. He gets credit for breaking up Standard Oil and other monopolies, but it actually was the guy who followed him, William Howard Taft, who was also a progressive Republican and became president in 1909. Taft was the one who actually finished the job. But that was the first real blow against monopoly. Then in 1920, and that kind of held through the Wilson administration. Wilson was not big on enforcing the law, but he was not big on backsliding either. And then in 1920, Warren Harding ran for president on a platform of more business in government, less government in business. That was one of his slogans. His other slogan was a return to normalcy. And by that, by a return to normalcy, what he meant was Wilson had raised the top income tax rate, which included a corporate tax, as I recall, up to 90%. And Harding, by his return to normalcy, he was saying, okay, we're going to take this down to something really, really low. And he did. In fact, in 1921, after he was elected, in 1921-22, he dropped it down to 25%, which is the same thing Reagan did when he came into office in 81. He took a 74% tax rate and dropped it to 25%. And the more business in government, less government in business, what that meant, more business in government means privatize government functions, and less government in business means deregulate. So Warren Harding ran on this platform of privatization, deregulation, embracing monopolies, and lowering corporate taxes. And so in that period from 1921 to 1929, we saw massive consolidation of corporate monopolies in the United States, absolutely massive consolidation. The rich got very, very rich. The poor got much poorer. The average working person was just squashed. It was called the Roaring Twenties because of the Gatsby style of the very, very rich, not because working people made out at all. And then, of course, you had the Republican Great Depression as a result of the crash in 1929 under Herbert Hoover's presidency. That set the stage for Franklin Roosevelt, who came in 1933 and, you know, won the election in 1932 and became president in March of 1933. And FDR then picked up the mantle from Teddy Roosevelt of going after the big corporations. And they were largely held in check, you know, through his administration, Truman's administration, Eisenhower's administration, and even the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, and to some extent the Carter administration. I mean, there was some steady growth of corporations or of monopolies during that period of time, but the doors got blown out in the 1980s of the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration was openly embracing monopoly, whereas all the previous administrations had considered it an evil, sometimes a necessary evil, but an evil. And Reagan's greed is good philosophy was right there where the big monopolistic corporations needed. There was this guy named Robert Bork, who throughout the 1960s and 1970s had been an academic. He had been a judge. He was a friend of Milton Friedman. He was big on the Chicago School. And he wrote a book on monopoly. I've got somewhere here in my office. Bork argued that there should only be one single variable that you consider when determining whether to break up a monopoly. Now, prior to Bork's sales job for this in the 60s and 70s, and the Reagan administration adopted his perspective, and then Reagan tried to put him on the Supreme Court, and then it came out that he was a screaming racist and you know, just a whack job.
Homophobe. Yeah.
Yeah, and a homophobe. Prior to Bork, the way, and Reagan, the way that we determined, or the reasons why we wanted to break up monopolies, were that there were multiple stakeholders that had to be considered when you were determining whether a monopoly was destructive to the stakeholders. There was the institution of the corporation itself. Would it be harmed by becoming a monopoly? There were the customers. Would they be harmed by it becoming a monopoly? There was the state in which the corporation was operating, or the general public, the welfare of the general public. How is that going to be affected by the corporation? And there was its impact on the economy overall. You know, so there was there were multiple stakeholders in this case. And what Bork said was, you can reject all that stuff. Throw that out. That's all meaningless. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is whether consumers are paying higher prices. If a monopoly leads to higher prices on consumers, then it's bad. If it doesn't lead to higher prices on consumers, then it's good. So Sam Walton basically eating the retail sector across America, every Walmart that opens typically causes 110 local businesses to go out of business within a few years. That was not a bad thing in the mind of Robert Bork or Ronald Reagan, because with their massive purchasing power and their acquisitions from China, which was not something that local businesses could do, Walmart was able to offer lower prices to consumers. In the 1980s, the Supreme Court, and I document this in the book, the Supreme Court bought into this Borkian argument, and that's how we've been regulating monopolies ever since. And it has brought us just economic ruin for everybody except the monopolies and the monopolists.
How do you fit monopoly policy into the contemporary fight between the two parties, between Trump and Biden?
I think that's yet to be seen. I've not seen a real clear articulation of Biden's economic policies. And I think the reason why is because Biden himself and the Democratic Party are going through some major changes right now in response to all the political upheaval we've seen in the last 10 to 20 years. You know, we are in the 40th year of a giant experiment from the end of World War II, well, really from the end of the Republican Great Depression until 1981. This country was running on an economic system that was, you know, classic economics, Adam Smith economics. Demand drives marketplaces. People buy things because they have the money to buy them. And that's called demand. And in fact, demand in econ speak is a phrase, aggregate demand is a phrase that is typically used to describe wages. So basically the consumer is driving the economy. Now, occasionally you have a supply of something becoming available that will drive the economy. For example, Steve Jobs invents a new kind of computer or a new phone and people want to get it. But that's the exception rather than the rule. The rule typically is that economies are driven by consumers. And Reagan flipped that upside down. He said, we're not going to do demand-side economics anymore. We're not going to do Keynesian economics. We're not going to do economics that are focused around working people. We're going to do economics that are focused around really, really rich people. And so it's supply-side economics, they called it. And that, you know, if we can get more stuff that's cheaper into the marketplace, then everybody wins. And it was a strong argument for moving all our jobs to China, or many of our jobs to China and Mexico and other third world countries, which, of course, is what happened to Reagan and Bush, of course, negotiated the NAFTA treaty. This was, you know, all this was the Republicans were just like totally into this. And then, of course, Bill Clinton bought into it as well, which was the beginning of a huge disaster for the Democratic Party that still looms to this day, which brings me back to Joe Biden, because Joe Biden had always basically been in the Bill Clinton neoliberal economic camp. And you've got probably a little less than half of the Democratic Party that is solidly in the Franklin Roosevelt demand side economics, Keynesian economics camp. And it's becoming apparent now, 40 years into this experiment, after some $15 trillion has been sucked out of the pockets of working people and middle class people over 40 years and transferred into the pockets of billionaires and huge multinational corporations, that supply side economics, Reaganomics, has been a disaster for everybody except the very, very rich. And as this is slowly dawning on the Democratic Party, I mean, this obviously it dawned on Donald Trump back in 2015. In fact, he had been railing about this for almost a decade before that. He was a Democrat, and he was echoing the positions of people like Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown, saying, we have to break up the monopolies, and we need to stop exporting jobs and importing goods from overseas. We need to go back to making things here in this country. We need to reverse neoliberal economic policies. He, of course, knew that that's where the American people were at, and talk is cheap. He ran on that. He campaigned on that. He won on that. But he was lying. All of his policies have been the opposite. They've been pro-monopoly, anti-small person, anti-labor, anti-small business. But Biden is struggling right now, and the whole Democratic Party, frankly, is struggling between these two factions, the old kind of Clinton-Reagan faction, the right-wing neoliberal faction in the Democratic Party, and the old-fashioned Democrats, the Franklin Roosevelt Democrats, the Harry Truman Democrats, the Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson Democrats, who believed that everything should flow from the bottom up rather than the top down. And Barack Obama kind of straddled both those worlds. He never seriously got into those debates, didn't do much about trade. I mean, he really only had 74 days, working days, where he had a filibuster-proof Senate, in which he could pass any consequential legislation at all. And it's amazing that he got Obamacare passed in that short window. So Biden, up to this point, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't really had to address this head on. But I'm guessing that he's going to have to as the election goes on. And this is where, his vice presidential choice is going to be rather consequential, too. Susan Rice comes out of the neoliberal school, or so it seems. I don't know that much about her economic policies. But if you look at her foreign policy, she was our UN ambassador, relatively conservative, and there's a lot of Republicans who are lobbying Joe Biden to pick her. Kamala Harris, I don't know. We'll see. She had an opportunity to put Steve Mnuchin in prison for the thousands of crimes he committed that led to the crash in 2008. She chose not to. We don't know exactly why. So we'll see. I mean, this is a huge turning point, struggle point, whatever, for the Democratic Party.
I'm curious about your personal take on sort of capitalism and its virtues versus monopoly, which you see more as a cancer. I mean, one of the remedies that you propose is more competition, and you've, built and sold some businesses. I've built and sold a business and I'm working on others. So I think there's small businesses and competitive businesses are really valuable, but the big businesses that run amok a bit or capture monopoly and are bad citizens give the whole system a bad name.
I think we need to define terms, Nathaniel. I've never been a capitalist because I've never made my living with capital. And I'm guessing that's true of you too. If you make your living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive from the companies in which you have invested, then you are a capitalist. Paris Hilton is a capitalist. She literally makes her living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. What you and I have engaged in is called free enterprise or entrepreneurship. We are small business people.
Sometimes you can move from one to the other.
Well, if you have a really successful business, every one of my businesses, I've sold them when they've reached the size where I could live off the money from selling them for a couple of years. Because my wife and I, when we got married 45 years ago, decided that we were not going to retire when we got old. We were going to retire as we were young. And our goal was to work 4 or 5 years and then take a couple of years off and see the world and then work 4 or 5 years and then take a couple of years off and retire. And we've done that successfully. I mean, that we were inspired by John D. McDonald's Travis McGee series, frankly. But had any of those companies, had I held on to them, I mean, we had a travel agency in Atlanta that we sold that has done over $250 million worth of business since then. And, you know, when I sold the business, it was for a little less than $1 million. So had I hung on to all these businesses, or even one of these big businesses, and it had made me rich as opposed to just comfortable, and then I used that money to invest in somebody else who was starting a business, and then I lived off the money that they sent me as a result, as dividends from my investment, then I would be a capitalist. Like I said, I've never been a capitalist. So when we talk about capitalism, we have to understand that there's a very, very clear distinction between free enterprise and capitalism as practiced as I described. But still, that said, I'm a fan of regulated capitalism. I think it's an okay thing if somebody I know is very wealthy and I've got a great business idea and no money to do it, and they want to give me $100,000 to start my business. In exchange for that, they get 20% of the company. Them being a capitalist, me being an entrepreneur, I see no problem with that. Because capitalism has the potential to become cancerous, we have to have an immune system for it. And what I mean, to explain the metaphor, normally our cells live for a certain period of time and then they die. And they reproduce a certain number of times and then they stop reproducing, whether it's a kidney cell or a skin cell or a liver cell or whatever it may be. Occasionally, some mutation in a cell will happen, typically as a result of environmental assault, exposure to radiation or poisons or whatever. And the DNA gets changed, so the internal mechanism that tells the cell to stop growing fails. And so the cell just starts going, I'm going on a growing spree, and I'm going to start dividing like crazy and get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and consume all of the energy, all the resources around me. I'm going to suck all the nutrients out of all the blood, and this is called cancer. And this is why cancers, they have their own vascular system. They build their own blood system around themselves to suck nutrients in, because they're sucking up the nutrients of the body. And this is why typically when people are dying of cancer, they waste away, because every other part of the body is being drained to supply fuel to the cancer. That's exactly how monopolies work. That's what we've seen in the airline industry. It's what we've seen in the food industry. It's what we've seen in the broadcast industry. It's what we've seen in the restaurant industry. It's what we've seen in the hotel industry. It's what we've seen. Pick an industry. Every major industrial sector in the United States has been turned into basically what you would call an oligopoly rather than a monopoly. It's not one company that controls it, but it's typically 3 to 5 companies, and they collaborate with each other. They may not do it conspicuously or out in the open in the ways that, the old monopolists did during John Rockefeller's time, where they get together and sit around and smoke cigars and play cards and decide, you can have that little oil vendor over there and I'm going to take this little oil vendor over here. It's not like that, but, when Delta changes their prices, United notices within 0.3 seconds and they change their prices. I mean, they're all dancing, in concert, and leaving a little bit of space for each other. We're seeing this in the ISP industry now. Comcast is just massive. Almost half of America is getting their internet service from Comcast. So I think that we are fully into now the cancer stage of capitalism. So if you view an economy as a living entity, like a body, it has to have an immune system. And the immune system that we built into capitalism, as capitalism was evolving in the 19th century, in the 1800s. And let's keep in mind, capitalism as an economic system is, in its modern form, is only 300 years old. The immune system that we built into it was the Sherman Antitrust Act and all the subsequent pieces of legislation that amplified it or strengthened it. We put the nation on immune suppressants when we adopted Robert Bork's theory of monopoly in the 1980s. And which led, of course, to the boom of mergers and acquisitions. There was this thing called the M&A mania. For those old enough to remember the 1980s, M&A mania was the thing. And the M&A guys were the captains of the universe, Michael Milken and all these guys who would just take these companies and smash them together into much gianter companies and then take a huge fee for doing it. And it was all encouraged by the Reagan administration. Well, that was because the immune system broke down. And frankly, we need to revive the immune system or our economy is going to die altogether.
If you could set policy and go after the first couple industries, which would be the ones you'd pick?
I think that doing it that way would be very dangerous and probably counterproductive. And the reason why is if you said, okay, I'm going to break up the monopoly in the radio and TV industry, you know, you can't own a radio TV station, more than 10 of them or whatever, then what you're doing is you're telling every other industry out there, we're going to come for you eventually. And you're also essentially proclaiming that you're going to do it the way that Donald Trump is trying to do trade with China, ad hoc, shooting from the hip, you know, being run out of my office kind of thing. And that's why Trump's trade with China stuff isn't working. American companies that are manufacturing in China have not, in the last 3.5 years, moved back to the United States. To the best of my knowledge, maybe one or two have relatively small ones, but by and large, they haven't. Instead, in fact, dozens of companies have continued to move to China, move operations, and not just China, because he's doing it by executive order, basically. What has to happen is Congress has to establish a policy that's applied across the board. And the policy has to have a philosophical underpinning, you know, a basis for it. And that basis has to be, we're going to go back to corporations having multiple constituencies. They're, you know, the employees, the corporation itself, the customers, the community, all of these are constituencies, not just lowest price for the consumer. And now we're going to evaluate every industry in America through that lens and ask, are the way these industries operating serving the public good, or are they harming the public good? Are they serving these multiple constituencies, or are they harming them? And then you would have an effective policy that would be long lasting. Just like if Congress was to say, okay, as Congress, we're going to put a 10% tariff on all imports from China and an additional 15% tariff on any products that are made in an environmentally destructive way, then you would see companies in China starting to shut down and come back to the United States, because that's now official U.S. policy. But because Trump did it shooting from the hip, these companies are just figuring, well, he'll be gone in 4 or 8 years and we'll still be here.
It seems to me the industry that you know a lot about firsthand is broadcast. How is that impacted by monopoly, and what are the political implications for that?
Well, starting in the 1920s with the Telecommunications Act of, I think it was 24 or 27, this was amplified in the early 1930s when the FCC was created. The idea was that media equals political power, not just economic power, but political power. You don't want to have any one individual or corporate entity, and back in those days, most radio and TV stations and newspapers were owned by families, not by giant corporations. But you don't want to have any one particular entity accumulating too much political power around the country. And so there were very, very rigid ownership caps. If you owned a newspaper in Chicago, you could not own a radio station in Chicago. If you owned a TV station, you couldn't own a newspaper. If you owned a TV station in Chicago, you couldn't own one in downstate Illinois, because you might end up dominating Illinois politics. Maybe you could own one in Detroit, which was, you know, much farther down the road. The whole point of the what were called the ownership rules, and these were FCC rules that were ratified by Congress, was to limit the political power of broadcasters. That all changed in 1996. In 1996, you know, Al Gore and a bunch of well-intentioned people along with him wanted to basically birth the modern era of the internet. The internet up until the late 80s, early 90s had been CompuServe and AOL, which operated over what we call the internet. So in the 90s, in 96, when Gore said he invented the internet, this is part of what he was talking about. He didn't say he invented it, but he brought it into being. They've crafted some legislation that did some really good things in that regard and cleaned up a whole lot of confusion and ambiguity about the internet. You can argue about, I think it's Section 320 or 230, that gives a limit of liability to internet providers. It's why, you know, Zuckerberg et al. Get away with what they get away with, and I'm an opponent of it. But at the time, it seemed like a good thing. And so there was this like reasonably good faith effort. And what happened was the telecommunications lobby tacked on the back end of this, basically an end to the ownership rules for media companies,
which had nothing to do with the internet. And so this was called the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Bill Clinton enthusiastically signed it. You know, like I said, Al Gore played a role in it. And within a year or two, Clear Channel, for example, had gone from being a small regional owner of a few radio stations to owning something like, you know, almost 1,000, and all over the country in every major market. And they had Rush Limbaugh in every major city. And political power and influence and propaganda all got intertwined in exactly the way that the people who wrote the early telecommunications laws in the 20s and 30s were worried about. And so that's where we're at now. We've got, you know, a small handful of companies that own virtually all of the media. Pretty much everything you read or hear or see is startlingly consolidated.
And tilted to the right.
Yeah, by and large. I mean, you know, and that's not, you know, because they're like fascists at heart. It's because, you know, the right-wing perspective has been, quote, pro-business. But by pro-business, they're not talking about the kind of business that you run or that I run. They're talking about the kind of business that, you know, United Airlines or Comcast or Dow Chemical runs, giant operations.
Tom, we're in a rapidly approaching the national election of 2020. You have this view through your show of what's going on, and it's an enormous inflection point, probably, in American history. And I think it's far from determined yet what's going to happen. What does your finger on the pulse say about what's at stake and what you're seeing?
Well, I would reference our earlier conversation about Joe Biden and the tightrope walk he's doing right now. I think the Democratic Party is struggling to recover its soul. I think the Republican Party has been hijacked by fascists and neo-fascists. And I think that those are the stakes. I don't think it's hyperbolic to say that if Donald Trump wins this election or by any other means stays in the White House past January 20th, that it's the end of the American experiment. I just can't say it more bluntly than that. And I absolutely believe that to be the case, given everything that's happened up to this point.
It must feel at least satisfying to be in the middle of that fight and be at it all the time.
you know, it is nice to have work that is meaningful. I'm guessing this is true of you too, that, you know, we feel like the way that we make our living, you know, not only puts a buck in our checking account at the end of the month, but also makes the world a little bit better place, you know, not just during the time that we're here, but hopefully long after we're gone. I have never in my life experienced the anguish. I was going to say anxiety, but that's not even quite the right word, about the fate and future of my country that I am right now. And I was very worried when Reagan became president. I thought we were heading for nuclear war and, you know, and the collapse of the American dream. The collapse of the American dream happened. Of course, you know, we went from a third of the American workforce having good union jobs, where, you know, they could raise a family and own a home and have a vacation and retire safely, to, you know, that being 6% of the American workforce. But, you know, the nuclear war didn't happen and the Soviet Union collapsed and all that kind of stuff. And I remember the anguish I had around the Vietnam War, you know, and the fear of getting drafted and having friends go off to Vietnam or a friend and not come back. I had several friends that did come back. One died. And, you know, that was widespread across the United States in the 60s and in the 80s. But in both cases, I felt, and I think my contemporaries felt, that this was a phase. This was a stage that the country would pass through. And eventually the Vietnam War would be over. And eventually Reagan and his wackadoodle, you know, Ronnie Reagan, let's have a nuclear dome that protects America. He saw this in a science fiction movie, you know, his whole Star Wars thing, the national shield. It never existed. I mean, to this day, it doesn't exist. But he spent trillions of dollars on it and you know, just pissed away enormous amounts of money. But we all figured that that would just be passing. This feels like it's not going to pass, that even if Biden wins in a blowout, and even if the Democrats take control of the House and Senate, there's now a well-established fascistic infrastructure that has a substantial media presence, a substantial think tank intellectual presence, a substantial presence in our colleges and universities, has seized control of our textbooks, and has a major voice in our media. And I don't think Trump is going away, and I know that the right wingers, the fascists, the monopolists are not going away.
I have to tell you that I can hardly contemplate his victory, almost physically.
Yeah.
If Trump were to go again, the anguish wouldn't be a big enough term for it.
Yeah.
And I really hope it doesn't transpire. Is there a question, Tom, about your book or about our current politics that you'd like to answer that I haven't asked?
I can't think of one off the top of my head. I mean, maybe who killed the Jetsons?
Who did?
Yeah. Okay. It was Reagan. In the early 1960s, Time magazine did the math from the tail end of the 1800s until 1960. Every decade saw a steady increase in worker productivity. You know, a worker would produce, you know, just to pull numbers out of the air, but for purposes of example, you know, in 1900, an average worker might produce $5 for their employee for every $1 that they were paid. By 1950, they were producing $10 for every dollar they were paid. For every hour that they worked. And so what happened was, as productivity went up, as individual workers were producing more and more goods, in part because of automation, pay went up. And it hit a peak in 1980. And then Reagan came in and flipped that upside down and said, no, you know, your pay's not going to rise anymore. Workers' wages have been literally flat since 1981. But in the 1960s, Time magazine did the math on this, and they said, okay, if worker productivity continues to go up the rate it's going up right now, and if pay continues to track it the way that it has grown with productivity since 1890, then by the year 2000, the average worker in America will be taking home $200,000 a year. And it was $30,000 a year in 1960 money, but you know, the equivalent of around $200,000 a year. And in fact, that's true. If workers today were paid based on productivity like they were in 1963 or 66 or whatever the year was that Time magazine did this article, the average worker would be making $200,000 a year. But instead, what has happened is that all of that additional money from that additional productivity has gone instead to the corporations and to the billionaires who own the corporations. So that's who killed the Jetsons.
Doesn't seem right.
Yeah. There you go.
Tom, it's been an honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
No, it's my pleasure talking with you, Nathaniel, and thanks for having me on your podcast.
That was Tom Hartman of The Tom Hartman Show. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with The Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.